Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Happy New Year, and thanks for listening.
I am announcing.
I am putting myself forward.
I announce my candidacy.
I'm Carly Fiorina.
I'm Ben Carson.
I am a candidate.
I am proud to announce my candidacy.
That I am running for.
I declare that I am a candidate.
This morning I announce I am a candidate for the Republican nomination.
I'm Lindsey Graham, and I'm running.
Today I'm formally entering the race for the Democratic nomination.
Today I am running.
I am running.
And I've decided I'm a candidate.
I am officially running.
I am governor of the great state of Louisiana. And I am running
today. I am proud to announce my candidacy.
Now I'm running for president.
The voices just kept coming and coming and coming in 2015 through spring and summer. They kept coming, men and women hoping to be the Republican or Democratic nominee for president. 10, 12, 15, eventually 20 major party candidates swelled the field of presidential hopefuls, four of them having personal connections here in Florida. This is the Florida Roundup 2015 year in review here on WLRN. Jeb Bush was back 9 years after he left the governor's mansion. Marco Rubio had had enough being U.S. Senator after one term. He wanted the White House. Ben Carson, a pediatric neurosurgeon, moved to West Palm and launched his White House bid. And then there was Trump, the Donald. He's been active in Florida real estate since the 1980s in Palm Beach, more recently the Trump National Doral Resort here in South Florida. And from the get-go, this presidential candidacy did not sound like the rest of them.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. They're sending us not the right people. It's coming from more than Mexico. It's coming from all over South and Latin America, and it's coming probably from the Middle East.
And that was just the beginning of the 2016 presidential race in the year 2015. Presidential politics in the Sunshine State, where we begin our look back at the year that was. Sergio Bustos, national political writer for the Associated Press here in Miami, back with us. Happy New Year to you, Sergio.
Happy New Year to you.
Patty Mazzei, covering politics for a part in the Miami Herald, with us from the Herald newsroom in our studios in Doral. Patty, Happy New Year to you as well.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Sergio.
Let's begin with... Jeb's money grab. Let's start there, I guess. 2015, Sergio, the former governor, spent the first 6 months of the calendar year raising a massive amount of money. How much ultimately did he have by the time he actually threw his hat in the ring in June?
Well, when you count his own political action committee, you know, his campaign committee, I should say, and then what's called a super PAC, which they can't work together, but they in essence do, you know, you're looking at well over $100 million. And the idea there was real simple. It would push out wannabes as presidential candidates and give him an open lane to the nomination. At least that was the thought.
That was the thought. And that was still the thought in June, Patty, when he was at the Kendall campus of Miami-Dade College and made official the worst-kept secret in modern politics. What happened?
We spoke to some people who have actually called that the best moment of his campaign, which is concerning because it was his first official day as a candidate, right? And it was actually a very good speech. He obviously practiced for it. It was a full crowd. People were very excited to be there. There was a lot of music. It felt very Miami, a lot of speaking Spanish, which is actually very true to who Jeb Bush is. He speaks Spanish at home. But then, you know, it was a day or two later that Trump gave that speech that you clipped, mm-hmm. and that changed the entire race.
And Governor Bush wasn't even the first South Floridian to enter the race. He was trumped, so to speak, by a couple of months by Marco Rubio, his one-time protege, who had another Miami-Dade College scene for his big launch into presidential politics. It was at the Freedom Tower. And the money grab that the Bush and the Bush team did, Sergio, didn't crowd out even South Florida voices from the presidential race.
No, you had a list there of, you know, you got Donald Trump, you've got Mike Huckabee also.
From the Panhandle, right.
Panhandle, and then, of course, you've got Dr. Ben Carson. What's interesting about the money was it did bump out Mitt Romney, who, if you remember a year ago, was the one candidate that seemed to be a threat to Bush. And he got him out. Supposedly.
Yes.
But no one imagined, you know, you'd have a dozen more people trying to run.
They just, Patty, kept coming and coming and coming, and Governor Bush never seemed to really get his campaign legs underneath him. And a lot of folks really in late summer and early fall began to second guess the governor's entrance in a really significant way, thinking that maybe he spent too much time out of public office. And the campaign was spent many times, many days, many months trying to rework itself.
Yeah, and it's hard to be nimble when you have a very large operation from the beginning, like you said, intended to crowd other people out. And so they struggled a little with that. They had to make cuts. They started really free-falling in the polls. And folks were writing a lot of advanced political obituaries for Governor Bush. And then he actually had a better moment in the last debate of 2015, where he decided to finally take on Donald Trump. And I'm not sure that it wasn't too late. I mean, you have to wonder why either Bush or some other candidate didn't take on Trump earlier on. They kind of let him build this huge lead in the early states. And finally, it was like, you know, there was nothing else to do but say that he couldn't insult his way to the presidency. That was the line that Bush used and quickly turned into a TV ad. But by that point, you know, the Trump machine had really worked. And people had thought this was going to be the year of political money, you know, where the super PACs were going to rule the campaigns and the candidates. And we saw quickly that candidates who had money in their super PACs, which they cannot coordinate with legally, Rick Perry, the former governor of Texas, Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, they had to drop out of the race even though their super PAC still had money because, as it turns out, you can't run a campaign just out of your super PAC.
You need more than that, and Donald Trump had continued to show that throughout 2015. Sergio, everybody in Florida was looking for a summer swoon by the front candidate, that being Trump. We never really saw it in Iowa, never saw it in New Hampshire, and we even saw within Florida, the Florida Republicans, not necessarily getting behind their two guys, that being Governor Bush and Senator Rubio, that I guess the political pundits a year ago had thought was kind of a shoo-in for those two.
No, even the latest polls that I've been seeing on Florida show Trump still in command, and actually Senator Ted Cruz, who's been making a move in Iowa and other places, is now making a bit of a move up in Florida. I thought it was funny because I interviewed Roger Stone a couple months back.
Former Nixon guy, former Trump guy.
Right, former campaign advisor to
Trump. Miami Beach resident, I believe. Now.
Yeah, and he left in a huff. Yeah. But he says he left and that he fired Trump. Anyway, nevertheless, that's so proper. But I thought he was very funny because he said to me, you know, it was supposed to be the summer of Trump and then it was supposed to be the autumn of Trump. And now it's become the winter of Trump, and Trump is still there.
Yeah, Trump is still there, Patty, and doing it without that, you know, big bank account from the super PACs. And we haven't seen the candidates hit the campaign trail in Florida with any significant intents, instead concentrating, obviously, on Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, those early states in 2016 that vote. But they have concentrated some of their fundraising activities down here for obvious reasons. You go where the money is.
Right. And Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Palm Beach is a big area, both for Democrats and Republicans. The March 15th primary in Florida was scheduled to potentially help one of the state's candidates, specifically Bush, who really had the bigger grasp of the Tallahassee legislature. You have to wonder now if they're thinking if that was a good idea after all. That was the first date that they could have a primary where all the delegates could go to the winning candidate of the primary. And by then, you will have had a Super Tuesday when a number of Deep South states are going to vote, which could be a bit of a firewall for Cruz, like Sergio was talking about, who's in a bit of a surge right now. And if you have Trump and Cruz kind of sweep the early states and then Super Tuesday, you know, I'm not sure how many Florida candidates will be left by the Florida primary.
Yeah, we'll know if Senator Rubio, in fact, who has put all his chips on this presidential race in terms of his political immediate future in 2016, not running for reelection in the Senate. This is somebody who's garnered some support, has shown life in the polls, Sergio, has weathered the criticism that he's not doing his job in the Senate by not showing up to vote for the people he represents in Florida, has weathered the criticism about his financial management, both personal finances and otherwise, when he was Speaker of the Florida House. But he's never been able to turn that into real significant double-digit responses in the polls.
Yeah, Rubio's campaign's interesting because he's kind of been a little bit more unconventional, you know, relying on kind of a digital play strategy, and then lots of TV ads is the idea. But I guess what's kind of emerged now, the storyline is, well, if you can't win Iowa, which is kind of Cruz Cruz country.
Yeah.
And if you can't win New Hampshire, which may be Trump or even Christie country, and then if you can't win South Carolina, you know, where do you win? That's been kind of a bit of a narrative nationally on Rubio. On the other hand, I think he's managed a very, very strategic and successful campaign. But as you said, it's not showing in the poll numbers. And again, you can blame some of that on the emergence of, you know, Donald Trump.
Of Trump. We keep coming back to that, Patty Mizzay. We keep coming back to this guy that has sucked up so much oxygen and so much support in the presidential race as it is in the staging effect, essentially, in 2015. And boy, you know, when you look back at his entrance into the race, you look back at the comments about immigrants, you look back even more recently in the comments about banning Muslims, none of that seems to not only be a knock against Trump, even in states that are heavy in immigrants like Florida. In fact, it continues to perhaps bolster his support that he sees in these kinds of states, Patty.
Well, I think the challenge will be for him to see how many of these folks actually turn out to vote for him, right? I mean, there are a lot of people who have not really made up their minds yet, especially in these early states where they're used to being catered to right up until the end. We do have, you know, several weeks before voting starts, yeah. February 1st in Iowa, February 9th in New Hampshire. There's also the question of how many people who are saying they like Trump in these polls are actually people who usually show up to caucuses and primaries. A lot of them, I think, are. In other cases, I think they may have never, especially in caucus states, you know, never gone through that process, which requires a bit of a learning curve. So if you don't have a huge operation on the ground, and Trump has actually invested more in that than I think he expected from the beginning, then how many of those people will actually turn out for you in the polls, and will there be a moment, either in the next debate or in the next few weeks, where voters will say, you know, this has been fun, but that's as far as we're going to get. I'm not sure that that's the case. I actually think the other candidates maybe waited, like I said, a little bit too long to decide to take on Trump in earnest. They just thought he was going to crumble on his own and misread the fact that he is, I think, very attuned to what sells. You know, what gives him news coverage, what let people like to hear. And he's made those adjustments as a candidate and really made himself more formidable as he's remained in the race.
I want to ask you how he and his rhetoric has changed the presidential rhetoric that we heard in 2015 and likely to continue to hear on into Election Day. But Sergio, back to this idea of the ground game that matters, that Patty is talking about, certainly in those early states and caucusing in Iowa. I'm a native Iowan. As a journalist, I've covered caucuses. It is cold in February, showing up at a church or a school at 7 o'clock on a February Tuesday, it's difficult to get people out there. Even the open voting in New Hampshire, it's still cold, could be snowy. The ground game was seen as the real asset of the Bush campaign. Not only the 8 years in Tallahassee with the connections that he has as governor, but also obviously the family connections, being the brother and the son of a president, that he had those connections in those early voting states and was able to put the ground game in and had the dollars to do it.
You know, I think at the end of the day, you're still selling a product, is what everyone says when you're selling a candidate. And the product that Jeb has put forth is that, look at my record as a Florida governor. And then I think that just isn't enough to excite people. Not to mention he was governor kind of many years ago.
Yeah. And in political terms, it was a lifetime ago.
And things have changed. You know, Twitter came about, Facebook, all these things. One of the point I was going to tag on to what Patty was saying about Trump is she and I both have been to some of the events with Trump here, and I have to tell you that I cannot recall, and I want to be careful in my words because I could get Twitterized by some of the Trump people because I've gotten messages from. But in all honesty, when you go to these events, it really is incredible the amount of passion these people have. And I've been to several other candidates' events, and what you get from them is, you'll get them saying one of three things. He can't be bought. This is Trump.
Trump.
He speaks his mind. He tells the truth in their mind. And then he also is not worried about being politically correct. You can almost quote each person that I've talked to that way. And the passion's unbelievable. And the number of people. And as Patty says, are those people just looking for the spectacle or the candidate?
Well, are those three ingredients plus the superlatives? It's terrific. I'm going to make it better. It'll be better than I'm a great negotiator. The other guy's an idiot. You know, Patty, apparently that's enough to build a truly serious presidential endeavor on here in 2015.
Well, what's interesting about the rhetoric that you were mentioning was the Republican Party had, you know, an autopsy, it was called, after the last presidential campaign in which they lost, and they tried to look at why they lost. And they set up the 2016 election with fewer debates, with a tighter primary calendar, intended to not bruise their nominee as much as Romney was bruised going into the general election. And in some ways, that could help Trump, because he's now the front runner, and so he might be less bruised, as it were. But also, they had reached some conclusions about having to reach out to Hispanic voters and other minorities that this campaign has just, you know, blown out of the water. They're not following their own conclusions of the last race. And so this campaign is going to determine whether they reached the right conclusions and then by not following them shot themselves in the foot, or whether, you know, they reached the wrong conclusions and something entirely opposite to what they intended to happen would work for them.
Well, Sergio, how do we see that setting up? To Patty's point in the Republican autopsy, a good chunk of that after the 2014 elections looked at the Hispanic vote, and after the 2012 elections with the loss of Mitt Romney. How is that squaring up from the candidates in the ground game that are being put in place in 2015, ready for that March primary?
Yeah, well, I think Patty put it pretty well. I would just add that I think that report that she's talking about by the GOP has huge coffee mug stains of Make America Great Again. It's the Donald Trump mugs, because it has been tossed out or at least ignored. I don't think it was done intentionally, because I think they did want to kind of grow the tent, as they will, expand the tent of voters, because in the end, Republicans do need to expand it. But it certainly hasn't happened with the Trump wall, if you will, standing in its way. And I say that joking.
Yeah, of course, yes. And plenty of candidates want to scale that wall in 2016 on into November. Sergio Bustos, Watching Politics with the Associated Press, and Patty Mazzei, a political reporter with our partner, the Miami Herald. Happy New Year to both of you. Thanks for joining us here on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you.
Still
you
to come on our program, a year of new relations with Cuba. It doesn't mean normal relations, but first, some of the smaller stories that were big news in our lives this year.
My name is Stephanie Smith. I live in Hialeah, and my biggest story of 2015 was when I became an aunt.
My name is Emma Rosenberg. I live in The Grove. My biggest story of 2015 was I got a dog. Her name is Olive.
My name is Anna Tinsley, and I live in Coral Gables. My biggest story of 2015 was when I realized that I was just like my mother.
We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN 2015, the year that was. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening, and Happy New Year. So 2015 saw a lot of firsts in more than 50 years. The first presidential meeting between the U.S. and Cuba in more than 50 years. The first visit to the U.S. State Department by a Cuban ambassador in more than 50 years. And for the first time in more than 50 years, official diplomatic relations, embassies and all, between the United States and Cuba.
I think we are now in a position to move on a path towards the future and leave behind some of the circumstances of the past that have made it so difficult, I think, for our countries to communicate.
That was President Obama in Panama back in April at the Summit of the Americas, where he sat down with Cuban leader Raul Castro. It was just weeks later the U.S. removed Cuba from its list of state sponsors of terror. It was a key demand of Cuba in the ongoing negotiations toward normalizing relations. But relations remain far from normal a year in. Thousands of Cubans fled their country in the past year, many trying to get to the United States. The number of Cubans entering the U.S. through Miami, it's more than doubled compared to a year ago. Tim Padgett watches the Americas and covers them for us here in Miami at WLRN. Tim Rogers is the Latin American editor for Fusion. To both Tims, Happy New Year and welcome back. Padgett,
and to you.
How much closer are the two countries today compared to a year ago?
I don't know if closer is the right word. More civil, I think, is the more appropriate term. I think we're finally seeing the animosity that used to mark communication between the two countries sort of going by the wayside now. And you're seeing a much more civil discussion that was pretty obvious in the early going when they were negotiating the reestablishment of diplomatic ties and the reopening of embassies. You saw a level of civil cooperation that for 50 years just didn't exist. Another good example, you mentioned the summit in April. Just mm-hmm. before that summit, you'll remember that there was a controversy about the Obama administration calling Venezuela, one of Cuba's staunchest allies, a national security threat to the United States. I think in years past, you would have seen Cuba fire verbal anti-aircraft missiles at the United States for making a remark like that. This time, you know, you looked at the official media in Cuba, and the response was relatively subdued.
Early in the year, Tim Rogers, the opposition to this new engagement with Cuba was pointing out that the United States was giving up a lot. We were easing travel restrictions. We were allowing corresponding bank accounts. We were allowing American credit cards to be used. We were essentially allowing people to self-select if they belong to the 12 categories of travelers that could go there. But the United States was not getting much in response back from Cuba. Later in the year, we saw negotiations over reparations take place in a very public way. We saw the ability to get U.S. commercial airlines being pushed forward in a very significant way. Is the pace of what we're seeing from Cubans and Cuba leadership beginning to pick up as we enter the new year?
I think for normal Cubans, the pace is a difficult thing to measure from a distance. I think maybe one of the most significant changes that Cubans, on-island Cubans, are facing is, like what Tim says, this paradigm shift. There's a civility to relations now that didn't exist before. Another, I think, really tangible change that on-island Cubans are facing is internet connectivity. There's a penetration of the internet on the island in the past year that didn't exist before. I think that it's a penetration that's happening slowly in comparison to other countries in the hemisphere, but for Cubans it's very significant.
Yeah.
And for the number of Cubans who are able to sort of connect to the internet with some degree of regularity now, it's a game changer how they relate to the world. You know, if you go to a park in Havana now, everyone's sitting around on park benches staring at their phones. No one's talking anymore, and that's progress.
And that's progress, Tim. It's something that we didn't see a year ago. But that connectivity has not happened by accident. It has not happened by circumstance. It has happened very intentional on the part of the Castro regime.
Yes, and this is one of the ways that you can say, I think, the Obama administration's new policy is working. It is, in a very, albeit subtle way, forcing the regime's hand in Cuba, because just the act of reestablishing ties with Cuba raised expectations among the Cuban population that even the Castro regime cannot ignore.
The resistance to the new engagement on the part of the Obama administration, Tim Rogers, has quieted down as 2015 continued on. Is that tacit acknowledgement or acceptance?
I mean, I think it is. I mean, I think that another sort of measure of progress is that the longer this goes on, the more it seems normal, the more it becomes the new normal, this era of engagement. And so some of the rhetoric that we saw for decades, really, prior to this engagement has disappeared.
One of the significant international visitors to the island this year was a visitor from the Vatican.
La importancia de una persona siempre se basa
Pope Francis saying the importance of one person is always based on how they serve the frailty of their brothers. The Vatican was seen as playing a significant role, Pope Francis a significant role in this easing and thawing of relations we saw in late 2014. What was the significance of his visit this year, Tim?
Well, there were two real significant things here. The first, just listening to what he was saying, in a lot of his homilies, he was making this point. It was a rather veiled jab at the communist government that he would say what's important here is helping people, not ideology. And I think he was really hoping that the Castro regime would take that to heart, that it's time to start thinking on both sides of the Florida Straits about helping Cuban people rather than politics. And I think he was also making a point that it's time for Cubans there and Cubans here to start thinking in a more unified fashion rather than this polarized world of, you know, gusanos here meaning worms, and just commies, you know, back on the island.
We heard that from Miami Archbishop Thomas Winsky, and prior to the Pope's visit, talking about how Archbishop Winsky, who was there for the Pope John Paul visit, mm-hmm. who was there for Pope Benedict, and was there obviously for Pope Francis's visit this past year in 2015, he talked about it as a moment of healing, healing bridges, healing families, healing relationships, not only just within the island and the diplomatic things, but really family to family, the family members that escaped, that left, to heal with those members still there.
Well, and more significant, I think, was Wenske's use of the term resentments, letting go of resentments. That was a real direct address to the Cuban-American community here as well as back on the island.
While America and Cuba spent the year getting to know each other again after more than 50 years of frozen relations, Venezuela continued falling apart, a deep economic recession there, skyrocketing inflation, all of it leading to a December election to remember, really, as Venezuelans threw out the Chavistas from the National Assembly, electing a coalition of opposition party politicians. This was the sound of celebrations in December in Doral as the opposition candidates secured a two-thirds majority. Tim, with this transition to take effect in 2016, this book has yet to be written in a big, big way. But what mm-hmm. could be the impact from the worsening conditions we saw here in 2015 from Venezuela?
Well, the fact that the opposition won not just a majority, but a supermajority, two-thirds, it gives them much more leverage to start fixing those economic problems, things like this currency disaster. You've got a currency that is on life support. It's a total dysfunction. Things like, fixing the worst inflation rate in the world, the worst economic contraction in the world, and also things like, you know, the worst violent crime rate in South America. So this gives the opposition a chance to really start addressing these issues that led people, even Chavista supporters, to vote against the revolution in December.
Tim Rogers, Latin American editor at Fusion. What about the U.S. engagement here? Clearly, when it comes to Latin American politics, a lot has been focused in 2015 on the Cuba relationship on the part of the State Department. But in the meantime, you know, Venezuela, the economy continues to crumble. Common consumer goods like toilet paper and toothpaste and even medicines are just vacant from store shelves.
Yeah, I think in terms of U.S. engagement, there's always a hypersensitivity in Latin America when it comes to U.S. engagement in the affairs of other countries, and with good reason. The U.S. has a rich history of meddling in the region. And also in Venezuela. I mean, the Venezuelans, the Chavistas, remember the 2002 failed coup attempt. And the United States continues to sort of pour in millions of dollars for what they call democracy building efforts in Venezuela, which obviously goes to benefit the opposition. The Chavistas sort of opt out of that. But I think to sort of look at what just happened in Venezuela and to say this is a product of the United States backing the opposition or meddling, I think is really dismissive of a lot of the problems that were happening in Venezuela that Tim just outlined, a crumbling economy, shortages, a currency that's worth nothing. And so to say that it was the U.S. backing the opposition is dismissive of those problems that Venezuelans pushing back against
perhaps,
the government.
Perhaps a bit short-sighted here, but Venezuela has played a role in that U.S.-Cuba relationship. I think you can see not only in 2015, because as that Venezuelan economy, Tim Rogers, has continued to be depressed. It has, and the Obama administration has acknowledged it, it has been able to push the Cuban engagement toward America. Oil prices are down. The amount of money that Venezuela can pour into Cuba has really hurt that Cuban economy leading up to this this thawing in relations. So as Venezuela and its economy suffers, it has perhaps played into America's hand or the Obama administration's hand, has it not, in regards to the engagement with Cuba?
Well, yeah. And I think that the talks between the Cubans and the United States happened right around the same time as Venezuela was really going off the rails. Yeah. And I don't think that that's a coincidence.
Meantime, in Brazil, just 8 months, the Summer Olympics are scheduled to open in Rio. Brazil has been racing to finish the facilities still, but the country's economy is in a significant recession. Its currency continues to drop. Oil prices continue to fall, and a corruption scandal has engulfed the Brazilian government. Tim Padgett, how has Brazilians and their economic woes there impacted South Florida here?
Well, in two ways, really. One, we're seeing perhaps less investment by U.S. business here into Brazil, although because Brazil's economy is being downgraded so much, there's almost a fire sale going on with assets down there. So we may see a lot more Americans going in. But more significantly for us, I think what we're going to see is more investment from Brazil arriving here, just wanting to get out of that disaster
flight
that's going
capital.
On there. Oh, very much so. Yeah.
Tim Rogers, what about any of the Brazilian economic mess threatening to spread to Argentina? We've seen slowdowns in Peru, slowdowns in Chile, as well as the global commodity prices have been dropping, which has been the base of those economies.
Well, I think you see a change of tack right now in Argentina in terms of dealing with the economy. The new president is trying to lift the currency controls in Argentina, and I think that the sort of the ripple effects of when big economies take a downward turn is felt throughout the region.
I want to come back up the continental shelf here into Central America now, guys. Thousands of migrants continued to try to get to the United States through Central America, but it wasn't like what we saw in 2014 by any stretch of the imagination. We didn't see the flood of unaccompanied children. We didn't see the flood of minors, of women trying to escape the drug violence in Guatemala and Salvador and Honduras. Instead, the migrants quite often were turned back before they got to American soil. Jessel Rosenius is one of those working to keep kids from going on the trek and staying in his home country of Honduras.
If I go to the United States, I don't help people. My country needs help. Help the little boys here.
Tim Padgett, you traveled in Honduras this summer looking at this migrant crisis. Any improvement on the ground?
Some, and I don't, it's not widespread yet, but I think the United States is finally waking up to the fact that, as you and I have discussed before, that in the best way to confront illegal immigration is at the source, not at the border. And so you're seeing the United States commit itself to more programs and projects that are improving conditions for the miserable lives, faced by drug violence, as you said, and poverty. And you're seeing pockets in Honduras, for example, where improved economic opportunity and, most important perhaps, improved security is beginning to spawn a little bit more confidence on the part of the people and in their minds telling them, maybe I can stay here. Maybe I don't have to make that trek through Mexico up to the U.S.
Tim Rogers, you traveled in Central America again in 2015. What did you experience on the ground there and compared to the crisis conditions that we saw in 2014 on the border in Texas and, of course, also here in South Florida?
I think a couple of things are happening. One, I think the U.S. has pushed the problem further south. The United States is trying to work with Mexico to shore up its southern border with Guatemala. And so you see a lot of the problem that was on the Texas border last year now playing out a little bit on the Guatemala-Mexico border. The deportation numbers are still high. It's just a lot more Central Americans are being deported from Mexico than they are from the United States.
And, of course, guys, this migrant crisis is not exclusive to those in Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador. We've seen a significant number of Cubans now look at this land route into the United States this year, and a significant number of them getting shut down, Tim.
Right, and but under a different impetus,
sure.
Let's say. Cubans are coming here in such deluge fashion right now because they're afraid that because of the new rapprochement between the United States and Cuba, they're going to see the Cuban Adjustment Act repealed in the United States, which is for decades has given Cubans fast-track legalization once they step onto U.S. soil.
Tim Rogers, it gets back to the Cuban relationship, even with the migrant crisis in Central America. We've seen a huge jump in the number of Cubans leaving the island, going through Ecuador, trying to go through Ecuador, and then Central America. We've seen more than doubling of the number of Cubans entering the United States in the Miami area in the past fiscal year. Are they moving because conditions continue to worsen in Cuba, the uncertainty continues to build? Or to Tim's point, is it because of concerns that now with this new diplomatic relations between the two countries, that wet foot, dry foot policy, the Cuban Readjustment Act and the benefits it provides Cubans, the clock could be ticking in the years ahead?
I think both. I think certainly they feel like they're racing against the clock right now. They see that wet foot, dry foot is becoming increasingly an untenable sort of Cold War policy that doesn't fit in this new era of expanding of improving relations. On the other hand, they also complain that the cost of living in Cuba is getting more difficult.
The Obama administration has said that it is the economic levers of this new relationship that it wants to use to build for a future in Cuba. We're 1 year in to this new relationship after more than 50 years, as we mentioned, Tim Padgett. Give us a sense of kind of where it builds from here and whether or not momentum has been picking up pace.
I think momentum has been picking up pace, and I think what the Obama administration, what we'll see from them next year is an even bigger push to get American business to reach out and perhaps even invest in, although it more sort of the angel investment variety, but to reach out and invest with small entrepreneurs in Cuba, particularly when it comes to things like, you know, getting internet access, because I really do think the Obama administration sees fledgling entrepreneurs in Cuba as sort of the new dissident.
Yep. Tim Padgett covering the Americas for us here at WLRN, and Tim Rogers, the Latin America senior editor at Fusion. To both of you, thanks for joining us and Happy New Year.
You too.
We got plenty more to come here on 2015, the year that was the Florida Roundup, police behavior under scrutiny. But first, more of those smaller stories that were big news in our lives this year.
Hey, my name is Juan Burgos. I live in West Kendall. My biggest story of 2015 was Pope Francis visiting the United States. Several of my friends actually went up to Philadelphia to see him. I was following them on Facebook and text messages that they were sending, and I felt like I was part of that group. Even though I wasn't there physically, I was there spiritually. It was really beautiful.
My name is Galen Troyer. I live in Miami Beach on South Beach. The most important thing that happened to me this year was that I saw the house I was born in.
Hi, my name is Lee Ferris, and I live in Brickell Avenue. And my biggest story of 2015 was getting my citizenship in the States. Because I've been from the UK, so I've been here for a year and a half. I just got my green card last month.
We're back on the Florida Roundup on WLRN 2015, the year that was. Happy New Year. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Police behavior came under growing scrutiny in 2015. From Baltimore to Chicago and South Florida, the relationships between law enforcement and the communities they are sworn to serve and protect were strained. In January, NBC6 here in Miami discovered North Miami Beach police used real mugshots of black men for target practice. Chief J. Scott Dennis apologized to North Miami Beach residents at a community meeting in January.
I know how I would have felt had that been my son's picture that someone was shooting at for whatever reason. Listen, you got to hear it from the heart. We are sorry. My police department's sorry, and I represent that police department. We made a mistake.
Now, the department denied it was using racial profiling. The city council wound up banning the practice. In February, Laval Hall was shot and killed by Miami Gardens police. Hall was carrying a broomstick, and police say he attacked one of the officers involved. Part of the shooting was captured on a dashboard camera. In October, Corey Jones was returning from playing drums with his band when his car broke down on an exit ramp from I-95 in Palm Beach Gardens. An officer in an unmarked van, and he wasn't wearing a uniform, stopped. Jones was shot three times and killed. Now, Jones had a gun with him, and he had a concealed weapons permit as well. Here's his family's attorney, Daryl Jones, in late October.
Still a lot of questions. There are serious questions about plainclothes police officers and their interaction with the public. And Corey Jones, from all that we now know, didn't deserve this. Didn't deserve this. We know this from the co-worker who had interacted with him, that he was doing what he was supposed to be doing. Waiting on the tow truck driver.
The officer involved in the Corey Jones shooting was eventually fired by the Palm Beach Gardens police force. Policing protection and behavior in 2015. Up here now on the Florida Roundup, Nadej Green is a reporter here at WLRN. Chuck Rabin covers crime and cops for our partner, the Miami Herald. Nadej, what strikes you in the past year about this police behavior?
One of the interesting things for me has been community reaction. I went out after Corey Jones was killed in Palm Beach Gardens, and so many parents were out at that protest with their children, school-aged kids. And this was an example, they said, because there were so many other shootings involved that were questionable throughout the year nationwide. They're like, but here's an example of a man who was not involved in any type of criminal activity, who had a permit to carry a gun. By all circumstances, he had done everything right, and still he was not safe. And so for them, they brought their kids, mostly, you know, black kids out there to say that, look, you're not safe. Mm. And it was an interesting conversation. And it was a different narrative that I'd heard throughout the year where, you know, the kids were actually there, like, to bear witness to this.
Yeah. Chuck, same question. I mean, what struck you about the community reaction as well as law enforcement reaction to these incidents this year?
I think Nadej is on target. The Jones case actually didn't have video, if I recall. But there's been so much video around that people are actually seeing what's going on, and it's bothering them because in a lot of cases, you know, the actions are questionable. It doesn't seem like anything is that much out of the ordinary compared to past years. It's just that we're getting a view of most of this stuff now, and it's not looking great.
That view is from dashboard cameras, sometimes from body cameras, from the cops themselves, Nadej. Sometimes it's from witnesses, cell phone. It's an inexact art, certainly, and all of these shootings have different circumstances. But are there common threads that have emerged with the incidents we've seen in South Florida, for instance?
I think one of the things we keep hearing after these shootings happen is that there need to be more video footage. The public and some police departments that I've spoke to said that this helps us, having dashboard cams, having body cams. In some cases, it's witness footage that have debunked some things or shown what actually happened. And so there's this larger conversation happening around videotaping police officers and making sure that there is something rolling at all times, because in the past we've seen that you rely mostly on police officers' testimony because oftentimes the person is dead.
Right.
And the officers are given wide latitude and they're typically believed. And so without video, you know, there is this concern that what if you're not telling the truth?
Chuck, we will likely see video play a significant role in the continuing investigation of the Miami Beach bank robbery shooting that happened just in December, right on Alton Road. Broad daylight and plenty of video.
Yeah, it was there for everybody to see. There was plenty of video, actually, in that one, taken from several different angles. And from what I heard, although you can't really hear this clearly, you know, the fellow was threatening others and said he was going to go back inside and harm people. But the video is very apparent, and you can see very clearly the guy coming up from the side with the taser and the other guy firing within a second of it, probably because of the sound of the taser. There's some policies in question and what went on there also.
Chuck, as we think back through the shootings, the police-involved shootings and the fatal police-involved shootings in 2015 that have happened here in South Florida, what about the commonalities? Yes, more video, but other circumstances involved. Each case is unique. Certainly each case is going to be investigated, and if it goes to through the criminal justice system, tried on its own merits. But are there similar threads of police training, police procedures that are getting questioned?
I just think that it's things are absolutely getting more questioned now than they were before, and a lot of that is because there's much more scrutiny going on, and that's because of video and what's been going on. There were you know, in November there were what, 7 people shot in about 6 days
that's
by different
right.
agencies.
Yep.
The first of that shooting, an officer fired through a window of a van that, you know, these kids had allegedly stolen and shot 3 people. Now they lived, but you know, a lot of agencies don't even have policy anymore where you can shoot at a moving vehicle unless you're threatened.
We also saw late in the year a Broward County sheriff indicted in a shooting that dates back to 2013, indicted on manslaughter charges. This was the case of Jermaine McBean. He was shot outside his apartment complex while carrying an unloaded air rifle. He didn't respond to police demands, essentially, to put the gun down or those kinds of things. He was listening to music, had earbuds in his ear. The deputy involved charged with manslaughter. Nadej, this is a case that was 2 years old by the time it gets into the criminal justice system. Is this unique that it had charges at this point?
It's not unique. I mean, typically it takes a while before police officers are charged. I mean, but this case was interesting, again, because of the public who bared witness, right? The reason this case actually came to a hold like this is because of New York Times reporting. Francis Robles was reporting out this story, and the New York Times was able to get a photo showing that this gentleman who had been walking with an air rifle had earbuds in his ears. The initial official story from police was, I mean, in the hospital when the family saw him, was that the earbuds were in his pocket, potentially indicating that he wasn't wearing it when he was shot. And so this raises a lot of questions. Did someone tamper with the scene? Because the photo of him lying dead on the sidewalk showed that he had earbuds on, so perhaps he didn't hear officers. And so all of that is likely because of a reporter who followed this through, and also because of a photo that existed that police did not get. The New York Times got it.
Right. And one of the big issue there, at least it seems to me, I don't even question that the officer was scared. You know, the guy was holding an air rifle, you know, and your adrenaline's rushing. Who knows what he's holding? You know, you're coming up from the side or behind. Maybe you don't see the earbuds. But whatever they did afterward, I mean, it boggles the mind.
Is that the next step in this scrutiny? I mean, we're scrutinizing behavior in the heat of the moment, and justifiably so, we would argue. But are we seeing the scrutinization of the investigations themselves, Nadej?
Absolutely. I mean, the public is very skeptical when it comes to these types of investigations, because historically we have seen that while police officers may get fired, they don't always get criminally charged after these cases. And so there are a lot of questions the public raise in how these investigations happen, who is interviewed, and these types of questions. So there definitely is a question mark when it comes to how police officers are investigated and by whom.
Chuck Rabin, more scrutiny, more investigative scrutiny expected?
Sure, and it's all good. And, you know, even though, you know, the stuff that's happening may not be any different than what's happened in the past 20, 30, 40 years, the public is getting a chance to see what's going on now. And the more they see, and the more it's discussed, and the more it's broken down until things get better, which ultimately I believe they will. Hmm. Because they usually do. It's a positive thing.
Nadej, you're a bit more skeptical of the veteran crime reporter's assessment there.
I don't know about things getting better. I mean, I think even with video, even with everything else, I mean, it still goes down to accountability and how these cases are investigated.
There's never going to be perfect circumstances. I agree with that. And there are segments of society, obviously, that get treated more unfairly than others.
But Chuck, we got to leave it there here. Okay. Sorry. As we look back at 2015, we'll continue talking about this with Chuck Raven, a senior crime reporter at the Miami Herald, and Nadege Green with us from WLRN. Finally, on the roundup, as we wind up the year that was, the big stories in our lives don't always make the news, clearly. They're not grabbing headlines or deserve a breaking news graphic on cable television news, but they're big stories for us, becoming a parent, graduating school, getting a new job. These are the stories that still matter.
Hello, my name is Matthew Martinez. I live in downtown Miami.
My name is Delilah Ulloa. I live in Buena Vista.
My name is Catherine Lantigua. I live in Kendall, and my biggest story of 2015 was the fact that I graduated with my BA from FIU in one of the best programs. Majored in international relations, and I'm ready to take over the world.
A year ago, my brother found a diary dated 1979, and it was a bucket list. And number one said, travel to Paris. And there was no number two, no number three. There was no other numbers on the list. It was the travel to Paris. And it was my mom's diary when she was a senior in high school. So 6 months ago, he told me about this. So we bought her a ticket, and we traveled to Paris for 2 weeks. It was really great. We had the opportunity to take her for her 55th birthday.
I came to a new school, and in my new school, I don't really have many friends, but I met this one friend, but she's kind of really annoying, and she's been ignoring me, and like I don't know why, and it's really annoying. So, yeah.
Well, we can only hope that the year ahead will be less annoying for all of us, and good luck with that new friend. That is the Florida Roundup 2015, the year that was, produced by Julia Duba and Alicia Zuckerman, with production help from Wilson Sayre. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Chiavelli Herrera. Our technical supervisor is WLRN's program director, Peter J. Maritz. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening, and Happy New Year.